Chapter 21 tonight. If one be slain in the land which the Lord your God gives you to possess it, lying in the field, and it be not known who has slain him, then your elders and your judges shall come forth, and they shall measure unto the cities which are round about him that is slain. And it shall be that the city which is next unto the slain man, even the elders of that city, shall take an heifer which has not been wrought with, and which has not drawn in the yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring down the heifer unto a rough valley, which is neither eared nor sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley. And the priests and the sons of Levi shall come near, for them the Lord your God has chosen to minister unto him, and to bless in the name of the Lord, and by their word shall every controversy and every stroke be tried. And all the elders of that city that are next unto the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley, and they shall answer and say, "Our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. Be merciful, O Lord, unto your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto your people of Israel's charge. And the blood shall be forgiven them. So shall you put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you, when you shall do that which is right in the sight of the Lord." The Lord gave Israel this ceremony to make sure that people would never take lightly the murder of an individual. Every effort was to be made to apprehend the culprit and bring him to justice. However, sometimes, no matter how hard you try, the murderer may be able to flee justice. It is in this case that this ceremony was to be performed. First, the jurisdiction of the murder was to be decided by how close it was to the town from where it happened. If the elders of that city were unable to locate the murderer, they were to bring a heifer that had never been put to work to a valley that was too rough to cultivate, but had a flowing stream of water running through it. Next, the elders were to behead the animal so that its blood would flow into the stream. They were to take the water from the stream and wash their hands over the dead animal and confess that they did not know and could not discover who the murderer was, and to ask God to remove the guilt of innocent blood from the people. From this particular law, the lesson that we need to learn for today is to make sure you understand how much our God despises murder. This is because man is made in God's own image. He will hold an entire nation guilty if they do not respect the life of every human being. We must do all that we can to cause people to understand the sanctity of human life. The death of any innocent person diminishes the race. We must never become so accustomed to death that we can ignore the death of the innocent. In 21, starting at verse 10, it says, "When you go forth to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God has delivered them into your hands, and you have taken them captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and have a desire unto her, that you would have her to your wife, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall put the raiment of her captivity from off her, and shall remain in your house and bewail her father and her mother a full month. And after that you shall go in unto her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. And it shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall let her go wherever she will, but you shall not sell her at all for money. You shall not make merchandise of her, because you have humbled her. One of the derogatory charges against the faith, especially when we look at the Old Testament faith, is that it puts down women. Quite the contrary is true about the law of God. Every regulation that deals with male-female relationships puts some protection in it for women. Within my own generation, there have been multiple foreign wars. In every one, some soldier has returned with a wife from the foreign land where he was sent. So this law is still relevant today as pertains to the believer. The first protection of the woman is seen when the woman is brought home and set apart in the man's house. In the desolation of battle, a man's passion is strong, and any beauty that can be found will draw his attention. So the woman, when set apart, is to remove her hair and her long nails and the foreign clothing in which she was first seen. These are symbols of her beauty. This is so the man, now back in the peace of his own house, can see her at her worst, thus eliminating a purely physical attraction. During this month, she is also given time to mourn the death of her family in the war. The man will also be able to observe if she can put these things behind her, so that she, in turn, will be able to love him. Remember, he may have been the person that put her family to death in the war. Then, if after all this, the man still wants to marry the woman, she then becomes his wife. Here, then, is the second protection for the woman. If the man finds out something about the woman that makes her unsuitable to be his wife, he was permitted to divorce her. When this was written, the reason for the divorce would be something serious that would be related in most cases to her foreign rearing, such as worshiping another god, and not something frivolous like her burning the morning toast. Her protection was that she could no longer be treated as a captive slave. If she was given a divorce, she was free to go wherever she wanted and do whatever she wanted. Throughout this entire process, you can also see that sexual relations were limited only to the period after the legal procedures had taken place. This is also a protection for the woman. In verses 15 through 17, if a man have two wives, one beloved and the other hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be, when he makes his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn, by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. While the law of Moses does not expressly forbid a man from having more than one wife, Jesus Christ clarifies in the book of Matthew that this was an unwritten law based on Adam and Eve. This was a period of transition as the people came out of Egypt and into the promised land. And some laws are written here to provide direction in unusual circumstances. Even today, when the gospel goes to certain groups of people who have always practiced polygamy, it takes more than a generation for the proper belief of one man, one woman can be thoroughly worked out in that group of people. This law emphasizes the problems of having more than one wife and clearly sets forth the right of inheritance. The problem of multiple wives is that one will always have the preeminence over the other. This can clearly be seen in the life of Jacob. The firstborn son, in this case, cannot have his right to receive a double portion of the inheritance taken away from him because his father does not like his mother. In our day of so much divorce and illegitimacy, this law provides the basis for proper child support by the father of the child. A man has a responsibility to provide for his children. Please notice that this was also another protection granted to women in this age too. In verses 18 to 21, if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him, and bring him out unto the elders of his city, and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. So shall you put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. This is a corollary law to the commandment to honor father and mother. The child in this instance is nearing adulthood, if not already there. He has been corrected by his father and his mother, but he will not listen or obey them. I think that an example of this son is found in the story of the prodigal son in the New Testament. The right of life and death do not lie with the parents. It lies with the community. It was only after a proper trial that a person described by this law could be put to death. There is no recorded instance of this law ever being used in Israel. More than likely, this type of son would have left home for a far country and saved the community the need to stone him. The principle is that there are those who become incorrigible and need to be removed from society for the good of the society. This is even true about membership in the church. Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. If a man have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be to be put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but you shall in any wise bury him that day. For he that is hanged is accursed of God. That your land be not defiled, which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance. in Israel, only four methods of execution were used: stoning, burning, the sword, and strangulation. The body of a criminal might be hung up for people to see that the execution was complete, and to teach the others as a deterrent. If the body was hung up, it was to be buried before dark. Desecration of bodies would lead to more wickedness in the land, so respect even for the body of an evil person was mandatory. This is another application of the fact that man is created in the image of God. In Deuteronomy chapter 22, starting at verse 1, "You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep go astray and hide yourself from them. You shall in any case bring them again unto your brother. And if your brother be not nigh unto you, or if you know him not, then you shall bring it unto your own house, and it shall be with you until your brother seek after it, and you shall restore it to him again. In like manner shall you do with his ass, and so shall you do with his raiment, and with all lost things of your brother's, which he has lost, and you have found, shall you do likewise. You may not hide yourselves. There is no finders, keepers, losers, weepers in the Scriptures." Quite the opposite is the truth of the matter. When you find anything, whether it is a domesticated animal or an inanimate object, it is the responsibility of the finder to attempt to locate and return the item to its owner. If this cannot be done because of distance or inability to locate the owner, the finder is responsible to keep the item safe until the owner is located. Perhaps the most commonly violated part of this law by believers is the little section about hiding yourself from them. You cannot pretend ignorance when you find a lost object. Some would do this so that they would not have to spend the time to return it. But this is one way that you love your neighbor as yourself. Another point that is that often we will bypass the object, hoping that we don't have to worry then about following what God has prescribed. We'll leave it for somebody else to find. So that's another point that you want to make sure that you don't fall into that trap. Jesus, in the parable of the Good Samaritan, extends this law to the care of those injured along a road. I know that it's dangerous to stop these days to render help to a stranded traveler, but it was also dangerous in Jesus' day, probably even more than it is now. If we are to fulfill the law of God, we need to plan to do it. One example would be to start out to our destination early so that we will not be tempted to pass on by because there's no time to stop and help the person. Deuteronomy 22:4. "You shall not see your brother's ass or his ox fall down by the way and hide yourself from them. You shall surely help them to lift them up again." As it was just said about the previous verse, we need to be prepared to aid those who are fallen down along the way. We must make sure that we do not hide ourselves from those that need help. Part of our preparation to help others is to make sure that we can help ourselves. if we are broken down along the way. Regular maintenance of cars is needed, and an emergency kit for minor repairs should be carried. If we are not the ones in need, then we will be able to help others. This can be carried further into our financial realm. If we have a goodly rainy day fund set aside, there will be money there also to help others. Please remember that it is our responsibility to help others and not to expect help from them. We are not to help only those who can help us, but also those who will never help us. In this way, we act as the Lord God acts when He causes the rain to fall on the righteous and the unrighteous. In verse 5, the woman shall not wear that which pertains unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God. When God created man, He made them male and female. There is a distinction between the two that God wants to remain. When a person is observed, it should be obvious whether they are a man or a woman. Clothing is one method by which this can be achieved. The New Testament also includes length of hair. So obviously cross-dressing is a sin. When this law was established, male and female clothing was very similar, much like it is today. Just as they both would have worn robes, today we may both wear pants. Yet, there must be something different about the clothing that emphasizes the difference between the man and the woman. When the distinction between male and female becomes blurred, that society will flounder and sins of a sexual nature will increase. Just as this is true with clothing, so also it is true when the roles of men and women become blurred. But that lesson is left for another law. In verses 6 and 7, if a bird's nest chanced to be before you in the way, in any tree or on the ground, whether they be young ones or eggs, and the dam sitting upon the young or upon the eggs, you shall not take the dam with the young. But you shall in any wise let the dam go and take the young to you, that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days. The particulars of this law are about a person traveling and in need of food. If they find a bird's nest, they may eat the eggs or the young birds that they find, but not the mother bird. The principle that is taught in this law is that we should never devastate something to provide for our needs. If the traveler were to kill the mother bird, the young would also perish. But by saving the mother bird, new young can still be reproduced, thus carrying on the species. I'm not a tree hugger, but how many times have we wasted some part of this earth that we have been placed in charge of its care to provide for our needs? And even worse, how often have we devastated something just to gain wealth or to provide pleasure for ourselves? There are consequences to every action. We as believers need to be wise enough to look at those consequences before we act to prevent ourselves from acting foolishly. In verse 8, when you build a new house, then you shall make a battlement for your roof, that you bring not blood upon your house, if any man fall from there. God expects us to have due diligence so as to protect others. The roofs of houses were often used for many activities at this time. to protect people from accidentally falling while on the flat roof, a wall was to be built around it. We need to take all reasonable precautions with our property and our actions so as not to cause other persons harm. We need to do this on our own initiative and not require the government to tell us how and when to do it. In verses 9 through 11, you shall not sow your vineyard with diverse seeds, lest the fruit of thy seed which thou hast sown and the fruit of thy vineyard be defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and an ass together. You shall not wear a garment of diverse sorts, as of woolen and linen together. God has created some things to go together and others that do not. The sowing of different seeds in the vineyard would have happened when a person tried to grow more on his land than he should have because of greed. This reminds me of the time I tried to grow pumpkins and watermelons in the same area. What I got were unedible puke melons. If one thinks about it, it was a simple matter of pollination that God's talking about in that particular case. The difference in size of an ox and an ass is obvious. They cannot pull evenly, and one or the other bears more weight than it should. This could be extended to human relationships also, where we try to match up a weaker and a stronger person in a particular job. Although linen and wool mixed cloth was common among American settlers, the reason God forbids the mixture is that because one is animal fiber and the other plant fiber, and the combination cheapens the garment. This becomes a matter of honesty. An unscrupulous person might try to sell the garment at wool prices, trying to deceive the customer. There are many areas in our spiritual lives we must take care that we do not try to mix unequal things. I used to want all those handy tools that could do everything until I got one in my hand and found out that it couldn't do any job very well. People are sometimes like this, the so-called jack of all trades but master of none. We must be true to all. God has fitted us to do the job well that He has set us to do, not the job that He has set our neighbor to do. And finally, in that chapter, verse 12, you shall make yourselves fringes upon the four quarters of your vesture wherewith you cover yourself. Even today, Orthodox Jews still follow this law. The fringes are literally twisted or braided cords. The purpose of these braids was to set the Jew apart immediately upon sight. The principle here is that the believer should be known by how he or she lives. There needs to be something different about us that sets us apart from the unbelievers around us. This does not mean that we go around wearing t-shirts or dangles that say that we are Christians, but somehow Christ needs to be seen in us. We are to be known by our love for one another. For this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. And thus ends the lesson tonight.